Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Elizabeth Berg, author of The Story of Arthur Truelove, published in November by Random House. Elizabeth was a registered nurse for over 10 years before publishing her first novel, Durable Goods. She has since written, maybe 25 books. Probably neither of us can remember the exact count.
28.
28, okay. She's been translated into almost 30 languages, has long been on many bestseller lists. She's won numerous awards and has also published a lot of nonfiction work. Arthur Truelove is a widower who is still very much in love with his wife. In fact, he sees her every day at the cemetery where he brings a folding chair and lunch and sits and talks. Not only that, he visits graves surrounding his wife and imagines their occupants as well. He imagines their lives, and in an almost magical way, his descriptions of their day-to-day activities and personalities ring as true as any other part of this novel. One day, Arthur spies Maddie, an intelligent and lovely young teen, who is spurned by her classmates, ignored for the most part by her father, who is also widowed. Maddie's mother died when she was just an infant. The third main character in this novel is Lucille, who's about Arthur's age, in her 80s, but is more gossipy, acerbic, and certainly more nosy. So this triad forms an unlikely but very likable group, and they forge a friendship seamlessly and bonding. How Elizabeth does all this is both touching and natural without being at all cloyingly sweet or manipulative of the reader. We fall for the characters and remember their names, even the minor ones, including Gordon, Arthur's cat. And all this is a book that takes you out of this very disruptive daily world and brings you to a place where love lost and then reborn, allows you to take a fresher look at the world in a much less cynical way, if you tend to be cynical as I do. And with that, welcome, Elizabeth, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So I guess my first question, and one that you probably get all the time, is how do you come up with new ideas after having written 28 books over so much time?
You know, the short answer is I don't know, except that I find life so interesting, and especially people's personalities so interesting. And that's kind of an ongoing picture show, you know, life, seeing how people behave, seeing what people do in their lives, trying to understand my own emotions about events and people. I feel like it's not a question of trying to come up with a new idea so much as it is a question of trying to pick among those ideas because of the richness of ordinary life.
And because the books are... Well, for example, if I ask you to describe for our listeners, I would ask you to describe a little bit about the three characters, because the book is not, it's got a great plot, but it's not plot-driven, it's character-driven.
No.
And so why don't you describe, so we can kind of set a base here for our listeners, a little bit about the three characters that I discussed in my introduction.
Sure. I would preface this description by saying that I don't plot my books. I don't ever know what's going to happen. So when characters show up, it's kind of like those old Polaroid photos that you could see develop before you. At first you'd see nothing, then it would be vague, and then they'd be clear. So any character I write is unknown to me pretty much at first, and then reveals her or himself as I go along. Arthur was what started the book. I kept seeing the image of an older man, Arthur's 85, going to a cemetery and sitting on a fold-up chair at his wife's grave, and I wanted to follow him and see who he was and what he was doing. Maddie materialized. She's a 17-year-old girl at the start of the book, sitting at the base of a tree, kind of an edgy goth type. I just saw her, and I didn't know what was up with her either. And she engages in conversation with Arthur, and it's there that her personality begins to be revealed, and they become friends. The third character, Lucille Howard, lives next door to Arthur, and as you alluded to. She's not the most pleasant of personalities, but she has a big heart. You kind of can't help liking her. So she's 83, Arthur's 85, Maddie's 16, and the three of them come together to form an unlikely family. Not what I intended to do, but what happens.
Yeah, I heard you on an interview once saying that you originally thought of Lucille as being kind of a meek and mild personality.
Yes. Not true.
No, not at all. But it seems as if lost love is kind of the glue that holds everyone together. But maybe I'm wrong in looking at it that way. Maybe it's their kinship in some other way. So what do you say?
I think that there are people who have all sustained a loss and who all are looking for some reclamation of love, and they find it in each other in ways that they might never have predicted.
Arthur,
when you know, it's like when you have a group of friends and you all have things in common and that makes you better friends. These people have in common that sense of loss and estrangement, and it makes them better friends.
But Arthur is such a kind person. How did he get that way?
How did he get that way?
Yeah.
I think that when I wrote this book, I was influenced by three things. One is Spoon River Anthology, Edgar Lee Masters' play about people who speak from beyond the grave. The other was Thornton Wilder's Our Town. And the third was my grandfather, who was an Irishman named Frank Loney and one of the kindest people you'd ever want to meet in your life. He made friends with a storekeeper he saw for 35 seconds. Everybody he met became his friend. And we grandchildren were crazy about him because he was eternally optimistic. And you could count on him being the place that you could go to, the person you could go to, more accurately, to take the bright side of things. So I wasn't thinking about him consciously, but when I look back on the book, I think, this guy sounds a lot like my grandfather.
It's funny that...
So I think that some people's dispositions are just that way, you know, that there are these rare people who just tend to see the good in things all the time and who are compassionate and unselfish, and they're around. They're rare. But they're around.
My father was like that. He died 23 and a half years ago, and every day someone tells me a story about him. It's just a quarter of a century ago.
I'm sorry. I'm having a little trouble hearing you. I'm going to try to adjust the volume of this phone. Okay. Could you please repeat the question?
Yeah, I was just saying that my father was kind of like that as well. He died almost a quarter of a century ago, and every day I hear people tell me stories about him. And it's just as if...
Oh, that's wonderful. That's how long-lasting that kind of legacy is.
But and that leads me into, I mean, this is not a magical realism type novel, yet when Arthur makes those dead people next to on either side of his wife alive, it really rings true. I really believed that these people were exactly the way as Arthur envisioned them. It just seemed right.
You know, I it's not magical realism, but it is. I sort of felt the same way when I was writing it, as he just has intuited something here. In a way, though, it doesn't matter whether he's right or wrong. What matters is that he understands that there are no strangers, that we really are all connected, and that every life matters. I think anyone who goes to a cemetery might think about some of the people there that he or she doesn't know and imagine lives for them. Sometimes because of what's written on the headstones, you get a little tip, you know, about who that person was, and then you go from there. But he loved his wife so much, he wants to know who her neighbors were. He has a lot of time to spend there, so he's thinking about things. So he just makes up lives for people.
Yeah, he does a really good job of it. And Maddie, is also kind, as Arthur is, but in a different kind of way. In some ways, she seems tougher than Arthur, and in some ways, she seems, I guess, less...
She's so vulnerable. She's just...
Yeah.
She's got no source of support, not at school, not with her father. She has no friends to speak of, and her boyfriend is just a wretch.
He's a mess.
So he's really the only ripe to find someone like Arthur.
Her boyfriend in the book is really the only bad guy, because I wouldn't call her dad.
Yeah, he is.
I wouldn't call her dad a bad guy. That's, you know, he's got his issues, but he's not bad. But the boyfriend's bad.
Sorry, you're cutting in and out there a little bit. Could you repeat that question?
Yeah, I was just mentioning that the only, as you agree, the only bad guy is her boyfriend. And I was going to say her dad is not a bad guy. He just has his issues.
He's damaged.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And in some, one of the reviews talked about, you know, the fact that there are only sometimes, you know, close relations between the young and the old. But your book explores an intimate, in the platonic sense, relationship between Arthur and Maddie. And it is an unusual one. And I've had a couple of those relationships, but they're kind of hard to forge because there's, you know, a generational disconnect.
I think they adopt each other.
Yes, goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm. He never had children, so in a way, she's like the daughter he never had. She doesn't have a father figure to speak of, so he becomes that.
And if lost love is the glue, as I said, it seems like that, without giving anything away, it seems like Lucille's loss is more poignant than anybody else's because she has regained something that she never thought she would.
And I know.
I know. I was sad. I mean,
yeah.
I was like, that was the only time I kind of got mad at you because it's like, why did she have to do that? But
yeah, I don't know why.
I don't know why
either. Answer to that question. That's interesting. I don't know why, but I had to do it.
One reviewer that I read talked about how she woke up one morning full of dread and anxiety, as I do often, because of what's going on in our country. And her mood changed as she fell into your book and read it in one sitting. And I think that's...
Oh, right. I know that review. Yes.
And I think that's very true. And I think that's true of a lot of your books. And and it's hard to do that without crossing over into, like I said, a cloyingly sweet or an emotionally manipulative way. It's hard, really hard to do that. Do you ever find yourself, you know, thinking about that at all?
I know exactly what you mean, and to me, this book, it sounds, I don't know how it sounds to say it, but for me, it was a kind of miracle of compensation for the way the world has become right now. And the book really wrote itself. It was one of those titles of my own that came really fast. And I had been working on a novel before this one that was really dark and depressing, and I just couldn't take it. I couldn't write a dark book and live in the world that we're living in now. So I wanted to be in a gentler, kinder place and escape somewhere else. And that's how the book came about. But I think every review I've read has said that it doesn't descend in this kind of saccharine place, which it might easily have done. And the truth is, I'm kind of a sentimental fool anyway, so it would have been even easier. But I think there's something really true about Arthur True Love. He doesn't seem like he's made up to be anything. It just seems like he really is, at least to me, a bona fide character.
I think part of it is that, and I might be stealing this from another review, is that you let people into the heads of each of these characters, into the minds of these characters. And I think
mm-hmm.
I think that projects a much truer kind of vision. And
that's again something that happened organically and really a way that I like to write. In a way it's like acting on paper because you you really do try to get inside the head, excuse me, of whatever character you're writing and see the world from their point of view. So, again, it was easy in this novel. These characters just seemed so real and present, especially as I went along in the book and they became realer and realer to me.
Completely off the subject of the book, but maybe on it a little bit, is it was really a coincidence, but when I was watching you on YouTube at a panel discussion with two other authors, you talked about the work of Karl Ove Knausgård, and I was reading. Yeah, and I'm reading My Struggle right now.
And, isn't it wonderful?
Yeah, and it's funny because you were describing how he can make pouring a cup of coffee interesting. Or smoking a cigarette, or, you know, eating sardines, anything. I thought about that, and I realized, you know, your book is kind of similar because there's food in your book, and when you talk about the food, it really does add a certain quality to the book. And
I like food. It's always in my book somewhere or another.
Yeah, it's basically what I was saying. I guess I'm saying is even the most mundane of activities are drawn with such clarity. And that's what I see in his work as well. So I think there's a comparison.
Well, that would be nice. Yeah, I really admire him a lot. I'm in the middle of his fifth book, and they're big, fat books, too. You have
I know.
To really like him.
I think
I think that... I don't know how he does what he does, as I've said many times. I just don't get it, how he makes something so mundane, so fascinating. For me, though, I think that so much in this book is metaphorical and serves the overarching theme, and that happened in a kind of unconscious way. So things became poignant for me that wouldn't ordinarily be so, because they were part of this larger story. I have to tell you, it's my favorite of my own books.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting.
My editor, too, feels the same way.
It's funny you said what you said, because like the interior monologue that Lucille has about... Again, I don't want to give anything away. How can I say this? The interior monologue that Lucille has about how the relationship is going to unfold and what the, you know, a kiss might be like, all of that is very poignant. And it does, you're saying it come, I guess I'm asking whether that interior monologue kind of came up out of your unconscious, you know?
Yeah, everything does. Yes, definitely. It's not a matter of deciding beforehand, I think she's going to have this epiphany. It, in a way, when I write, it's like being a reader at the same time. I don't know what's going to happen. It just unfurls before me, so to speak. And that's the, whenever that happens, that's the best kind of writing for me. That's always the best material.
When I was listening to that panel discussion, the author to your right, I've forgotten her name, she talked about outlining the novel and making sure that she had everything in place. And your approach is completely different, obviously.
Completely different. And and I think that that's something that anyone who aspires to write should recognize right off the bat, is that the best way to write is the way that's right for you. And there are a lot of different ways to write. I think Ann Patchett is a writer who knows everything in advance. I have a great deal of admiration for her, and her books are wonderful. And that's how she does it. And I'm the opposite. But you have to follow what works for you and what satisfies you most, and in my case gets me the most excited. And what gets me excited is to not know.
Well, to ask the question that is always the question every interviewer asks is, what then is your process? You know, you wake up in the morning and then what?
I am a pretty self-indulgent boss. I only work when I feel like it, but I almost always feel like it. And on the days that I do work, I try to work first thing in the morning, so I'm closest to the dream state, because I think that's where all the good stuff comes from. When you have a dream, you're not editing yourself. and I like to write that way as well. So I'll work in the morning for about 3 or 4 hours, and then I kind of hit a psychic wall.
That's funny, because...
So, I don't know if you picked that up. That was a car starting.
Yeah, I got it.
Beeping. But anyway, was that okay, or do I need to repeat?
No, that's fine.
Answer. Okay. So, that's how it is. I'll work until I'm just beat, and then go on with the rest of the day.
And it's funny, that's like NASCAR too, because a lot of what he writes is, well, you know, it's the most, it's like remembrance of things past, which is the comparison people always make with his work. And he's, you know, and some people are upset because it's too autobiographical and hurts the feelings of some of his family. But a lot of what he writes comes from what you were just saying, from the dream state. You know, he has these dreams from the very beginning of Volume 1, when he sees the face in the water, and, you know, it's this fantasy. And I don't know. I'm a big fan. I don't mean to dwell on him. It's just that not only am I a big fan.
I think he's wonderful. And it's funny how many people haven't heard of him. Do you find that?
Yes, definitely. In fact, everyone I talked about it, I own an independent bookstore, and all the... my staff had never heard of him. And also, I didn't realize there's also a sixth volume that hasn't been translated yet, I guess.
There is a sixth?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Autumn. Do you know about Autumn?
No, I do not.
So he has a smaller book. It was written for his unborn daughter. And it's going to be all four seasons.
Huh.
So Autumn is out now. Also beautiful. Have you ever heard him read?
No, I have not.
Oh, boy. It's a revelation. If you ever get the chance, go and hear him read. It's very simple, just like his books. He speaks conversationally, very quietly, and it's absolutely mesmerizing.
And he's 48 years old, so if he continues to do this, he's going to have 10 or 12 or 14 volumes by the time he reaches, you know, 70 or something like that.
Well, he's such a phenom. I can't imagine that, you know, in terms of what he needs financially. He probably doesn't need to write another book. And I just can't understand why more people haven't heard of him in this country when he is so phenomenal. And when I saw him at the University of Chicago, he had a huge audience. So, I'm not sure what's happening. Maybe it's a certain segment of the population that knows about him, and other people just don't.
Yeah, they said,
but,
you know,
boy, I share your admiration.
They said with a population of 5 million, I guess at least 10% of the Norwegian population has read his book or his books. And as I said earlier, I think the fact it's definitely not plot-driven, because it's a collection of mundane things that appear serially, and then sometimes
that make up a life.
Yeah, that make up a life, exactly. And that's why I made the comparison to your work, at least this last book of yours.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is a compliment, because we both feel that he's a master of it. And it was really surprising in the interview to hear you mention his name, because I was reading it, but again, I don't think anyone on the panel ever knew who he was.
Was that the panel? Was that Off the Page in New York? Random House did?
Yeah.
That was good. I liked that panel.
Yeah, because each of you had something to contribute.
Right.
Yeah,
and
from a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, with that, thank you so much for being here. It's a great book. It's on the front table of at the bookstore, and because it's Christmas, people come in and ask a lot of times, I want to read something that's not, you know, going to make me depressed, or
really?
You know, that I want to give as a Christmas present, but I don't want the person to think that I'm giving them like the denial of death or something like that.
Yeah,
so
it's perfect for that. I have to say.
Yeah, we pick up that book and we hand it to them, and it's helped our store, and it's been a bestseller.
Thank you. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Bye bye. That was Elizabeth Berg talking about her new and her favorite book, The Story of Arthur Truelove. It's it's heartwarming, but when you say that, people think, oh, I don't want to read a heartwarming book. But it's not, as I said, cloyingly sweet, and it's not saccharine, and it doesn't manipulate you into crying or something like that. It's uplifting, and it can be read easily in one sitting, and you'll probably want to. We've got a lot of good people coming up. One that I'm really looking forward to is John Bacon's The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. And what it's about, which I didn't even know, and you probably don't either, is about this explosion in World War I in the Halifax Harbor of this ship that was carrying an enormous amount of explosives bound for England and France to help fight the war. And the explosion that occurred because of incompetence and a series of unfortunate events was the largest explosion ever to occur and be witnessed next to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was 1.5, maybe more, kilotons. And it had some of the same hallmarks as those later explosions, including a mushroom cloud and a shockwave that flattened buildings for miles around. So in any event, thanks for joining us. We have a lot of good stuff coming up, and I look forward to having you here next week on The Avid Reader.